Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the tailgate podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. Nick, 7 days ago, we talked about how today we were going to have actual games to analyze. I don't think either of us could have anticipated that we were going to have as much action to dive into as we got, which only means that in the same way that the groundhog didn't see his shadow, and that means it's 39% likely that Christmas or spring is even farther away than it would otherwise be, we're gonna get terrible games for the next 3 weeks. So we got a saber today, right?
Uh-oh. If we're starting this off with connectivity issues, listeners, buckle up. The last thing that I heard Terry say was that Christmas is coming early. And 0-for-1, but I appreciate it. And just so the listeners know how hard I work to bring value to their lives, I had a flight to San Diego to broadcast on ESPNU tonight, and I am still making the time to not only watch some of the games, but to sit down with my good friend Terry Foy. And what a game. And this was one of those, like, every week one. And technically it's week zero because season actually starts next week when your Notre Dame Fighting Irish play. But I'm kind of like, all right, you know, we'll see some blowouts. There might be a good game or two. What a day, Terry. What a day. It's really back. It really is. And it's in your face. It's not the slow, hey, there were only a couple, like, three-goal losses. Wow. What a time. What a time to be alive.
No question about it. And I think we've got one other element of the weekend that we've got to dive into before we start with the games, which was my Saturday night. Do you want to tell the listeners what you received via text message?
So I was so mad at Terry, and he made me feel the wide range of emotions because I'm like, Terry, what are you up to? He was at a dog wedding. Name something more Caucasian than a dog wedding. You can't. And so he's like, he sent me a picture, and it was a dog, four-legged, paws, tail, the whole thing, a dog, in a bride dress, in a bridal dress. And I was like, Terry, I just lost so much respect for you. Here I was thinking that you were a man of honor, a man of integrity, a masculine role model in an otherwise feminine world, and you're going to a dog wedding. The content that you sent me had me go from I'm mad at you to I am so jealous that I'm not there. Can you just give us a 30-second rundown of the dog wedding?
Well, so it was a fundraiser for the local chapter of, I believe it's the ASPCA, but BARCS is what it's called, the Baltimore Animal Rescue Agency. And I have a friend who is a huge supporter, and this is, you know, their gala that they throw every year. And it's funny because I've been to a human wedding at this venue, and I felt like I couldn't send my friend whose wedding I went to, like, photos or videos from this because it was like, yeah, sorry, this is kind of like just as nice as your wedding was. And it's also funny because, you know, I'm 39, my wife's 40. And so we're kind of out of that window where we go to 10 weddings a year for 5 consecutive years or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I'm ready to go to a wedding, even if it's two canines marrying each other. So shout out to Barks. It was a blast. And shout out to those things that spin the camera or the iPhone around you and shoot video, which I only ever really associated with Brian Kelly and LSU football upon arrival. So those things skyrocketed up my cool meter after experiencing it for the first time and realizing the incredible content that could be created by having a camera spin around you 360 degrees.
Can I post that?
Sure.
Oh, that's so great. Because again, those, I don't know who invented those. I hate them because they're all the same. And then there was just something, Terry, I couldn't tell you about it. Maybe it's the look at Terry. This isn't what he should be doing. And look at how much fun he's having. I don't know. It made me feel – have you ever seen the movie Secondhand Lions?
Yeah. It's one of my dad's
It kind of made me feel – it's first off, if you haven't seen that, go watch that right now. And it was similar to when, you know, like the guys who I usually know, the two grandpas that are so tight, when they buy their – like the clay shooter to shoot the guns, I'm like, oh, look, they're having fun and everything's going great. I felt that same sense. It almost brought a tear to my eye. So dog wedding, content inbound. I'm very excited to post it. And is there anything else we should talk about before talking about lacrosse? Because I personally could go on for about 45 minutes about this.
No, I think we got to dive right in. I think we're going to start with Johns Hopkins versus the Denver Pioneers, which I was at, and the game was absolutely incredible.
This was a game that, hand up, I'm a coward. It was about halfway into the fourth quarter, and I was like, I'll just switch the game, go get my packing done, check Twitter real quick, and then sprint back to the TV to watch the end of it. Now, a theme that I noticed about this weekend, teams just deciding to take a dump and give the game away, really. We'll talk about it in Colgate Penn State, but this one, I feel like the number one thing that you do, 2 seconds left, is you press out on adjacent shooters. So I'll let you kind of take it through the game, but I have thoughts about the end of the game.
Yeah, so it's tough for me to divorce my preconceived notions of each team heading into this game with what I saw, especially for the first roughly 55 minutes of the game. I'm going to start by saying that in totality, and you're going to hate this comparison, I'm so excited to see your reaction to it. This game reminds me a lot of the Baltimore Ravens loss to the Indianapolis Colts early in the season, where it was like, clearly the team that coming into the game was the favorite and everybody, you know, thought was going to be really good, lost for reasons that are kind of unexplainable because they, I want to give Denver the amount of credit that they deserve over the course of the first 55 minutes of the game, which is more than my kind of expectation of them coming in would have suggested, because, you know, this game was tied 5-5. Denver scored first. This game was tied 5-5. And then, with, you know, I think about 10 minutes to go in the second quarter through, you know, roughly 7-8 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, Hopkins separated and effectively controlled the game with a 2-3-4 goal lead throughout. And I thought, you know, on the basis of the feedback that we got, well, first of all, my expectations for this team on the basis of what they were last season and who they brought back, in addition to, you know, what we had heard about their scrimmages against Navy and High Point, you know, I was really interested in seeing how they were going to initiate offensively, because, you know, it's a team that moves the ball well and has good shooters, but doesn't have a ton of dodgers, you know, and when you look at it from the standpoint of how Hopkins was going to attack that defensively, I thought that what we saw over the course of the game was a Hopkins team was actually pretty sticky on ball, but they were slow to react off ball, and it created slits in the defense, or, you know, opportunities for cutters to find the backside. And ultimately, I thought that when Denver scored, they were doing so either on goals that Chase Erland didn't see, or they were really well-placed shots. But again, I felt like that the story of the game was kind of twofold. The first is that you would have expected Denver to have a significant advantage at the faceoff X in Alex Stathakis, and that didn't manifest. So that was important, you know, both for the way the game was going to unfold and also for how Hopkins kind of should expect their season to unfold going forward, because they went toe-to-toe with a really good faceoff guy and did not find themselves at a significant possession disadvantage. So shout out to Logan Callahan for a really nice game there. But then separately, this is an offense that is going to run 9 midfielders, and there are maybe 0 offenses in all of college lacrosse that are going to do that, or at least in Division I. So I feel like it's an opportunity and a challenge. Number one, it's an opportunity because you've got injury insurance, you've got matchup redundancy, and you can ride the hot hand depending on who it is. But it's also a challenge because, number one, you got to mix and match and find out whose chemistry is vibing both that day and on the course of the season overall. And then on top of that, like, you know, you got to give everybody an opportunity to see if they have it that day, right? You don't want Dylan Bauer or Ryan Evans to feel like they could go in and can 2 or 3 shots and just not get them on the field because they're not traditionally in the top 6. And so I thought that that's what we saw. And I thought that that's what manifested specifically through the third quarter. And I think a lot of the credit goes to Jacob Angeles, who's an unheralded player because Russell Melendez is kind of the, you know, go-to dodger, so to speak, and Garrett Deignan is a very dangerous shooter. Both those guys were pretty quiet over the course of the day, whereas Angelis had 3 goals and 3 assists, and he's the facilitator. So when he can be dangerous as a goal scorer, I think it really puts opposing defenses back on their heels in terms of trying to pick their poison for what they're going to defend. I think most teams come in expecting to defend him as a feeder, and so if you have to defend him as a goal scorer as well, either initiating the dodge or dodging off the catch, all of a sudden now you're really 360 degree oriented. And again, from a matchup standpoint, in terms of who's where, then it becomes difficult to track. Hunter Chivette, a freshman lefty shooter from Lawrenceville, originally from Cleveland, Ohio, shout out 216, was awesome. 3 goals in his debut, the first Johns Hopkins player to do that since Shaq Stanwyck in 2015. Good company to keep. And all of that swirled up into this point at which the Blue Jays had a 12-9 lead. It was 11-9. And it felt like on the basis of that ninth goal in the fourth quarter that that Hopkins needed to get a 12th insurance goal. Otherwise, it was going to be really tight late. And they got it off of a Jonathan Peschko bouncer. And then J.J. Shilstrop showed up. And this is the part that is the most difficult to try to separate the preconceived notion from the actuality, because, you know, Shilstrop was a highly touted player coming out of high school. And early in his career, he was just kind of behind some really talented offensive players who were ahead of him in the depth chart. He was getting on the field, but he wasn't necessarily putting up huge numbers because of the, you know, kind of component personnel. And then when you look at last year and you take kind of the scrimmages from earlier this spring into account, it's like, here's this enormously talented player who is clearly a number one attackman, but what does that actually mean? What does it look like? And Dan Kaplan and Patrick McCune were at those scrimmages, and they felt like he wasn't asserting himself, probably because, you know, he's trying to give oxygen to the rest of the guys who might need it a little bit more, like Michael Lampert, Noah Manning, and some of the midfielders who are kind of breaking in. This is also a really good time to point out that Richie Connell and Mick Kelly, two of their more important offensive pieces, weren't available for them either. So, you know, a combination of Denver coming in shorthanded, being the underdog, having to travel west to east, play a noon start Eastern time. Not only that, but also doing it in your head coach's first ever head coaching game and working with a new offensive coordinator. It all swirled up into, like, if they were going to come out with a 1 or 2 goal loss, it was going to be an impressive result for the Pioneers. So to put together one of the most unlikely finishes you can imagine is just rocket fuel for the rest of the season. So with all that being said, Nick, explain what happened with 2 seconds left in regulation and then again in overtime, and give us your thoughts on how the end of the game unfolded.
So initially what happened there was, do you know the exact time, like 2.3 seconds on the clock?
It was either 2.6 or 2.9, but yeah, it was 2 point something.
Yeah. And so the ball was starting on the goalie's right side. Shilstrop, the lefty, was up top. Clearly, that was the play. You have 2 seconds left. The difference between 2 and 10 seconds is night and day. You do not have time to run a play. You do not have time for off-ball movement.
And he had just scored 2 goals to his third and fourth goals of the game.
The hot hand. And so what we can write off as excusable versus inexcusable, to me, this becomes interesting because they left Shilstrop open. Granted, he was from the parking lot. He was above the box. It was a goal that should have been saved, quite frankly. But one pass to Shilstrop, who had his feet, who had his hands, who had a clear lane to the goal. He steps in, shoots it. Everybody goes nuts. He then scores in overtime. And so the thing that's indefensible to me, I thought it was...
Well, hold on. I do want to add one caveat to this, which is there was a non-releasable penalty with 10 seconds to go. So they were man down. Hopkins actually won the faceoff in overtime, but it was a 2-minute non-releasable. So they weren't able to actually kill the penalty. So Denver clears after Hopkins got a shot. There was a question as to whether or not Brooks English got a piece of the goalie, got a piece of the pipe. Originally, the reset was given. It was then reversed. And so Hopkins was restarting the play with 10 seconds left on the shot clock, decided not to go to the goal, basically killed the possession, didn't throw it into the coffin corner, threw it into the far side of the field. Denver was able to restart, clear, live ball. The penalty was actually released by the time the goal scored. And it was given as an even goal, which means that the stat keepers identified it as the defense was already like renumbered up, I guess would be the best way to put it. But Silstrop definitely found space due to a slow backside slide. And what an unbelievable shot. I mean, it was one of Hunter Chivette's shots that actually went viral earlier in the game. Very similar location, low to high, bar down, game over. It was unbelievable.
And like the couple things that blow my mind, the first and most inexcusable coaching, mental lapse, player error. I don't know what was put in as the defensive strategy. 2 seconds left. If I'm a defenseman, I'm thinking, okay, they might be running some crease action. They might be doing this, but the hot hand is JJ Silstrop, who just joined this, by the way. JJ, how are you?
Good. How are you guys?
We're great. Thank you so much for joining us on the tailgate.
We appreciate it. And you just caught me right in the middle of a breakdown of, okay, so there's this guy, JJ Silstrop. He's the hot hand at the end of the game. And for whatever reason, Hopkins decides to leave you open with 2 seconds on the clock for a step down with your eyes, with your hands. Let's just get your perspective. Were you kind of like, all right, if you're going to leave me open and there's this much time left, I'm just getting it and firing a piss missile. Were you surprised to be open?
It was kind of interesting because they're man down. So didn't really know what to expect from them. But kind of just got lucky, found some room and sent a prayer out.
Well, you know, as a Notre Dame player, the prayers are answered for the Irish, not for the Pios, but I'm glad that we were able to lend you a little answered prayer. And then just walk me through again, because we just kind of did the breakdown of how it happened. How cocky do you have to be to throw a low angle, low to high, near side to win the game?
Again, we've had a terrible man up to start with. It was short time. It was like 26 seconds. So it was kind of not enough time to really get a good, a great play in. And then we just scrambled well, made a great pass from Cody Malowski and just caught it and tried to get it on net there.
JJ, let's open up the scope a little bit and talk about this game in the context of, you know, what it meant from the standpoint of starting your season. So the storylines are robust. You are in your coach's first game as a head coach after, you know, his predecessor, an absolute legend, announced his retirement prior to last season. And then you find out mid-year that Bronny's going to take over. So you go through the fall, you integrate a new offensive coordinator in David Metzbauer, one of the legends of the game in and of itself. And then you have this opportunity to head to one of the most historic venues in the sport to get your season started. You're playing a 10 a.m. Mountain Time start, and there's all this kind of like uncertainty. Now, granted, it's balanced against the fact that you return a lot, right? There's a lot of guys that have a lot of experience, but you were also without two meaningful contributors who were unavailable to play in Richie Connell and Mick Kelly. What was the attitude of this team going into this game in terms of, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, there is a lot that we know about ourselves, but there are also a handful of decks that are stacked against us?
I think that we had last year, we kind of had the excuse of guys not really having a ton of experience, but after last year, we now have guys that have got some meaningful minutes, and now that we have two of the best minds in lacrosse in the same office talking offense is something super special. And it's been super fun for me just kind of having, feeling like a freshman again, kind of learning all these new plays and perspectives. So it's been fun. And then just going into this game, just no pressure really. Right. We know what we have and we just went out there and had a great game plan and executed. So It was shaky at times, but we thankfully got it done at the end.
So how do you describe your role? Because when I look at your personnel in this offense, you know, a couple things stand out. The first is you guys have a lot of what I would describe as pretty similar athletes in terms of, you know, size and stature, you know, combination of power versus quickness versus speed. And then, you know, you you don't have, I mean, you have variety in terms of you have some strong dominant righties, strong dominant lefties, and then, you know, roughly equally distributed in terms of guys that are willing to go to their offhand. So that's one thing that kind of, you know, is a little bit different and can put guys in certain spots on the field. But then also the personnel seems to be heavily shaded toward, you know, ball movers and shooters as opposed to Dodgers who want to get to the dirt. So how do you regard your own role in that? And how do you regard the analysis overall? Am I, you know, kind of giving anybody a short shrift in terms of what their role is or should be on the, you know, top nine offense?
We're interesting because I think we can mold to kind of whatever it needs to be that week and kind of just schematically, we can kind of fit into different roles and we can get to the middle. We can kind of find space and work off ball. And we got guys that, like I said, we've got a year under our belt now, and we're able to kind of adapt kind of week to week, and we all have kind of strengths that are own games that we have. Now we have Coach Metzbauer and Coach Brown that can scheme up stuff for us. So we don't have like the prototypical X attackman kind of taking over the game, but we got six guys and guys on the coming off the bench that can open up some opportunities for one another.
Thanks for those questions, Terry. I almost fell asleep. So JJ, how much of a difference is it in intensity and practice preparation and offensive schematics going from Coach Tierney, who I would argue kind of had a similar to, you know, Notre Dame's Coach Corrigan, where I would be worried about them yelling at the refs and I would be worried about everybody during practice. Does Brownie bring a little bit more of a calmness, a system to it? And kind of what does that exchange and changeover look like?
It was a lot more quiet on the sidelines yesterday. The refs, it was a little different feel, but no, we were so happy for Coach Brown to get that first win, and the transition has been great. Coach C is still coming around. He was at our little inter-squad scrimmage last weekend, and it's been a great transition. We're so happy we got that one with Coach Brown yesterday.
And then could you just talk about, I mean, Brownie, I hated trying to play defense against offenses that he were running because there would always be these Canadians. The shot clock makes it a lot different because you can't just wheel it around with, you know, 10 Canadians and burn the entire, you know, second quarter. How big of a difference in the preparation and offensive schematics has it gone from Tierney to Brown?
It's been a little different. I know on the defensive end, Coach Gallant's been doing a great job kind of base of kind of sliding, recovering, and kind of now getting pressure out a little bit more and just kind of continuing being tough and physical, but adding a new little bit of flavor with Coach Gallant's stuff. And then on the offensive end, it's just been just really encouraging creativity. And like I said, with those kind of six guys on the field, we don't really have a role. So we all got to be able to kind of just do a little bit of everything. So it's been fun. Kind of, again, having that transition from Coach Tierney to Coach Brown, just everything kind of feels fresh this year. So it's been really enjoyable so far.
Got it. And then last question for me, you went to LCC, La Costa Canyon out in San Diego. For better or worse, and unfortunately, Mike Reese is one of my good buddies, yeah, the legendary LSM that took Denver to their first national championship. He asked me to ask you when he can expect a thank you letter in the mail. And do you want to give him any type of shout out here on this public platform?
Reese is one of a kind. He coached me sophomore year of high school. And
he just put coach me in air quotes. No,
he was a fun coach that can light up the mood. But no, he's an unreal guy. He did a great job of kind of helping me transition from high school to going to Denver, just kind of understanding the culture and the standard there. And no, he's unreal and what a guy.
Yeah, when I think Mike Reese, I think culture and standard. So a very good shout out, and we'll get this back on track. Terry, what do we got?
No, I don't really want to get it back on track. I want to take it a little bit farther off the track. So JJ, Nick is obviously from Denver, and we're speaking to him while he's in San Diego right now, whereas you are from San Diego, and we're talking to you in Denver. So I want to get a little bit of the Metro rivalry going. What is the where is the food better, Denver or San Diego?
I mean, you can't beat Mexican in San Diego. There's nowhere else like it.
Yeah, you can. You can beat it in Denver. Yeah, because, oh, yeah, my mom and dad took me to all the good spots. How about you leave Denver's campus, you go into Denver, you go into Wheat Ridge, even though you wouldn't last a second there, and you find the good spots. I'll send you a list of some of the best spots, and then you can actually do a good compare and contrast, because putting French fries in burritos doesn't make it quality cuisine. Really good green pork chili does make it good cuisine. And Terry, I don't even know if you know this, but Wheat Ridge actually played La Costa Canyon my junior and senior year. Wheat Ridge went a startling 0-2. So as far as the lacrosse scene is concerned, I don't really have a whole lot to say, but you know, it's just kind of interesting that all these San Diego kids idolize and want to go to Denver. And I don't know too many high level recruits going to play for USD. So just going to throw that out there.
We played Wheat Ridge my freshman year in high school.
How'd it go?
It was all right. We won, but
yeah, you got lucky. You got lucky.
I think
it was all the refs.
Didn't they They folded the next year, right?
Well, and JJ, could you give an RIP for Wheat Ridge's lacrosse team? I don't have a high school alma mater. The program folded, so you got lucky. LCC got lucky.
I will say there's some great guys on that team. Good banter.
Last one from me is, so we got the cuisine question out of the way. Let's talk about the outdoor life. JJ, have you ever been rescued out of the Pacific Ocean?
I have not jumped off of Sunset Cliffs high tide with
only the bravest around, only the bravest.
Yeah.
Lesser men would have died in those currents. So credit to me for still being here and able to conduct this professional and thorough interview.
Yeah, I actually do have one. Yeah. Is it possible as a Denver lacrosse player to actually get out on the mountain? Like, I'm sure that there are like kids that want to go play lacrosse at Denver because they imagine that they're going to have this opportunity to like ski or snowboard. And then they get there and they're like, oh my God, the commitment of being a part of this program just makes it that I can do it like once a year. Are there guys on your team that actually figure out a way to make it happen?
Like maybe once over our winter break, because we're on the quarter system. So we actually... we finish the first quarter around the couple days before Thanksgiving, and then we don't come back to school till early January. So some guys are able, like most, it's a great selling point for most kind of just regular students at the school because they have that whole kind of all of December to get up into the mountains. So we have a couple guys that do it, but it's like Koshy always said, just don't ruin it for everyone else getting hurt. So it's just kind of risk reward, but we got a bunch of guys that enjoy fly fishing out here and a bunch of golfers on the team. So not a bad spot.
Yeah. And Denver's a lost city. If you want to go fly fishing and get on the mountain, come visit me in Boise. I'll show you the actual fresh rivers. We'll show you the good snow. We'll show you the lack of people. It's beautiful. I encourage you to visit anytime. Last question for me, who's your least favorite DU lacrosse alumni? Cause I have a long list that I could go over, but do you have any least favorite alumni? And is it Mike Reese?
It's not Mike Reese.
Or Wes Berg.
It's definitely not Wes. Wes is he's a true San Diego guy now. He's actually comes over to the house all the time. He's what a dude. He's unreal, and he's just another one of those guys that just you can't speak highly enough about, and just kind of a great mentor since I've been here. Excited for the boys or the San Diego Seals tonight to get a big one over Colorado here.
So Trevor Baptiste is your least favorite Denver Pioneer alum?
No, definitely not. Too. That guy is I can't say – again, I just can't get – like all of the alumni that have come through here, just special people. Coach Tierney made an emphasis on he recruits the person, not the player. And it's carried over to Coach Brown, and we got a special group of guys.
No, if you can't get into Notre Dame, DU is a great school. So really appreciate you taking the time.
I've got one more, JJ.
No,
we've done a lot of analysis of this game, but what we haven't talked about is what role did these custom Carhartt vests that the parents got play in this victory? Nick, you don't even know about this, but check this out. How badass is that vest?
Oh my God.
I don't even know if you can see the logo, but there you go.
That's actually sick.
It's got it's It's got the kid's number on the back too.
Oh.
So JJ, Carhartt vest, scale of 1 to 10, best present that parents ever got.
I mean, they're up there. It's good to know the parents got style, because we're looking pretty tough out there with no decals.
Great, yeah, so is that going to stick? Pun intended?
I don't know. We'll see. We're just, again, I'll give you the coach speak here. We don't care what we're wearing. Don't care who we play.
Wow,
we're
gonna show up. Great answer. Great answer, JJ. And trained well.
Yeah.
Doing Nico proud. JJ, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Good luck next week as you take on the Fighting Falcons from the Air Force Academy, another program that Nick knows something about.
Get it, guys. Thanks for having
me. All right, take care.
It is a bummer, because as much as I like to trash DU, I do some power rankings about like my favorite alumni bases, and DU is right behind Notre Dame. They are awesome and fun. And, you know, credit to me for building the Denver culture of lacrosse in the first place, but also credit to the young men going through that program that end up being the next Westbergs, the next Mark Matthews. The stories coming from their campus are elite tier and shall not be discussed on this. Maybe we start a Patreon. Maybe we put part of this conversation behind an OnlyFans and we just get down to the nitty gritty about what Wes actually did in college and what Mike does today. And we have a great time doing it, because I would love to slander those two.
All about it. Name the time and the place. I'll be there. That being said, let's keep it moving. We've got 30 minutes in the bank on the biggest result of the game. We've got 30 minutes to go. The biggest result of the weekend, excuse me. 30 minutes to go. We got a lot to get to.
I'm staying with Cooper Perkins, my broadcast partner, who is just crawling behind the screen. And I just had to show Terry about Cooper's army crawl. So this is a good episode. I like this already. Let's keep it moving. What are we talking about next?
I mean, this has to be the biggest upset of the weekend. And it was Colgate going into Happy Valley, Panzer Stadium, and taking care of business against the number 4 Nittany Lions, coming off of an NCAA semifinal berth in 2023. Unbelievable result. Nick, what do you got?
First off, credit to Coach Carwick. He is a great leader of men, huge statement victory. You know, Colgate, good program. They got an Idaho kid, Wiley Warkall, on their roster, so they have the grit. And this was another game that I hate to start off on kind of like the focusing on the sloppiness, and I want to give Colgate their credit. But for whatever reason, it just seemed like we can't just write off Penn State's mistakes as, oh, that's just kind of some first game, you know, willy-nillies. They gave the game away with some of the worst and egregious turnovers and failed clears, not just once, but consistently. The clip that was going viral was that last clip where Colgate scored with 4 seconds left to win the game. And I don't know what was going on. Take a sand wedge and you know, throw it up in the air and hit a flop shot. Do anything other than passing it right into the middle. Do anything on the clear other than consistently turning it over. Like, that was kind of the big takeaway for me, is there are ways that you can rational and back your way into first game sloppiness. And then there's red flag, bam, 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 alert, alert. That needs to be addressed first thing Monday morning in practice, because apparently the clearing game from Penn State, and again, I apologize to just start off on such a negative note, but losing to Colgate is an inexcusable loss for them on what should have been a very winnable game. Could they do some little things that you are not only expected to do at any Division I level, let alone the top, at a very high rate? So again, I'll say it for the third time, apologies to start off on a bad note, but Penn State, what are we doing? Learn how to clear, learn how to not shit your pants with 10 seconds left and throw the worst turnover that we've seen since the viral Lindenwood clip last year.
So you teed me up perfectly. You literally could not have teed me up any better, because the first thing that I want to say is, while Matt Carwick deserves a lot of credit for what he did in preparing this team for this showing, I also think that it's worth shouting out Judd Lattimore, an assistant who joined the staff in the offseason coming over from Boston U, and definitely brought that 10-man ride with him. You know, Judd has been running 10-mans since his time as an assistant at Bucknell, learning under the great Frank Federaca way before 10-man rides were cool. And it played a huge factor in the fact that Colgate caused 15 turnovers in this game, and they certainly don't win without those caused turnovers. So there's a lot there. And you know, we shouldn't not mention Hunter Druin, 4 goals and an assist to lead the offense for the Raiders. You know, watching this game back, I thought that Colgate did a really nice job of taking advantage of Penn State's aggressiveness defensively. I thought that there were a number of goals that Penn State gave up because they pressed too far out on the perimeter and gave opportunities for effectively guys to make one move, run past their defender and end up one-on-one with Jack Frassion. But with all that being said, I also want to talk about this outcome in the context of basically how Penn State's season started in 2023. And I want to start by saying that if you're Penn State or Johns Hopkins, you have to remember how last year started, because you went on to have really nice seasons, right? So this matchup last year was pretty one-sided. And, you know, I remember watching the end of it after it was probably like a 3-4-5 goal game. And I thought that Penn State made some pretty egregious errors down the stretch in that game as well, in terms of being over-aggressive, not having things buttoned up. And then if you remember, which you should, because we talked about it while I was in the car driving home on Super Bowl Sunday last year, I went to Penn State at Villanova, and that game was decided by three Penn State failed clears that directly led to their loss to Villanova. They got that cleaned up, and then they, you know, turned into a Final Four team over the course of the rest of the season. So the point that you made about it being priority number one on Monday, it surely will be, and it'll be interesting to see how that manifests going forward. But it also shouldn't go without saying that the way they were clearing was going to be different because of the fact that they were doing it against a 10-man. Like, there was one instance, Matt Kinnear and Dan Kaplan were watching this game live most closely for us, and I was at Hopkins Denver. And so, you know, in our company message, we were talking about the game, and you know, Kinnear was trying to figure out why Kyle Lehman was pulled out of the game in the middle of the second quarter, specifically whether he was injured or not. Lehman was the number 19 ranked freshman in the class. He finished with a goal and 3 assists. It looked like he played pretty well. So Kaplan was rewatching the game this morning, and he talked about how, you know, it looked like they pulled him out mostly as a calm down moment, right? Just an opportunity. You know, he had made two plays that led up to his being withdrawn that weren't necessarily, I don't even know if they were turnovers, but they were on the brink of turnovers. And so it was one of those conversations where it was just like, you know, hey, this is what we're looking at, whatever. But Kaplan also made the point that they were using Lehman to drop deep and be the guy who caught that last exchange pass that was supposed to break the 10-man and then allow you to get into your settled offense, and how that might be a really tall task for a freshman playing his first collegiate game. And so that's the type of adjustment, especially when you've got Matt Traynor, who played midfield last year and is an upperclassman. He could be the one receiving that pass. Or TJ Malone, who, we should not let this go without saying, had 7 assists in this game, a goal and 7 assists. Some of the scoring numbers that were put up, not just JJ's 6 goals, but also Evan James had 9 points. I mean, there were some big, big goal totals in this weekend, and we're going to get to a couple more of them. But when it comes to why Colgate won, you know, I think we've pretty well addressed it. Really nice offensive performance, taking advantage of Penn State's settled defense. And when I say settled, I don't mean that these were all in you know, straight up 6-on-6 situations. I'm saying that they were settled in the sense that it was like a defenseman guarding an attackman, you know, maybe still in an unsettled set, but in a play where he should have been able to match feet and stay in front of him. And Colgate did a nice job taking advantage of it. But ultimately, the opportunities that they got themselves were definitely a function of the pressure that Colgate was able to implement or apply on Penn State. And a lot of that had to do with their 10-man.
Yeah, well, and I will say, like, the good takeaway from Penn State was, you know, anytime I see 7 assists, I kind of just like, all right, were these actual assists or did he pass it? And then, you know, one-on-one dodge score. I mean, credit to Malone. He was crushing it, not just like those 7 assists were legit, couple behind the back, couple highlights. So him as a facilitator and distributor is going to be a pretty big nightmare for any defense. So I just felt by my negative start, I had to say something good. And I think that was the biggest takeaway. Get everybody involved on the O. You'll figure out the 10-man. And one of the questions that I'll ask at the end, but I just want to prep you for, how big of a weekend was this for Selection Sunday a couple months from now? So that's going to be I don't like Notre Dame having not too many games because it looks like we're off to a wild start to the season. And speaking of wild starts to the season, here's one that I thought wasn't going to go into overtime, let alone, you know, have Maryland on the ropes. Maryland, Richmond took Maryland to overtime and
double overtime.
Two for Tuesdays, couple extra bonus for the kids. That was, I would say, the second most surprising result is Colgate beating Penn State, number one, awesome. Richmond, sneaky, that's the team that you don't want to see, and they confirmed that against Maryland this weekend.
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot of meat on this bone, and it starts with it's going to take Maryland time to figure out who they are offensively. And it's a combination of Eric Molliver's reinsertion into the starting offensive unit and how there's going to be a little bit of a two-headed initiation partnership with Braden Urksa, which we talked about last week, and the relationship between those two guys and then the four shooters finishers that are going to be complementary around them. And it, the reason it takes time is because it requires a lot of familiarity, a lot of chemistry. It's not as easy as just giving one guy the ball, letting him dodge to the dirt, draw a slide, throw to the open man, hit a step down. This is going to require multiple pass possessions, and it's just a high wire act. You know, I've talked about it a ton over the course of the last 3-4 years. Boston University, really good example of it. And to me, I've always compared it to three-point shooting dependent team in basketball relative to a team that relies on a low post scoring presence, or in Joel Embiid's case, a high post scoring presence, or a guard initiator like a Derrick Rose or a Tony Parker who's going to get to the basket every time. And even if they're not the one finishing, they're laying it off for a dunk or kicking it out to an open shooter. The Golden State Warriors, when they go cold, there's not a lot of other places to turn. And I do think that Maryland's offense is going to be a little bit like that, especially early in the year, and they're going to find their footing as the year goes on. Meanwhile, they're going to find solid ground at the other end of the field, and Logan McNaney's return definitely is one of the things that contributed to that. Now, with all that being said, Dalton Young, Richmond's attackman, was, according to multiple people that were at the game that I've spoken to, the most dangerous offensive player on the field. So, you know, the Spiders are the opposite of what I just described. They've got one guy that they know they can put the ball in his stick and he can make something happen. And it's not just him, because Aiden O'Neal, while he didn't have the same total game production that that Dalton Young did, he did have two huge goals in the fourth quarter in order to make sure that the Spiders stayed in the game. And then the last guy I want to shout out is short stick D midfielder Jeff Nugent, who was an energizer bunny in the clear, consistently legging out and creating separation such that there was no pressure on the ball. It'll be interesting to see how Maryland adjusts to this from a ride standpoint going forward, whether or not they want to try to apply a little bit more pressure. And certainly Loyola coming to town next weekend is going to be an interesting one to see whether or not that comes to fruition. But yeah, Jeff Nugent, an unsung hero of the game. I was surprised. I don't know what led to Richmond's starting goalie choice not being Zach Vigue. That was one that took me by surprise. So we're going to have to look into that a little bit. But aside from that, yeah, I mean, you know, two good teams going toe to toe. Ball game went to double overtime. It's as close to a tie as you can get. Certainly the rankings suggested that Maryland should have been favorites. So did the line. But, you know, it ended up being a game where it's sports, you know.
Well, and I thought a really interesting quote from Tillman was him just straight up saying, like, there's not a lot of difference between our midfielders. Like, we don't have a first All-American guy. We have essentially six 80-ranked Madden players. And to me, it's not necessarily a red flag, but for Maryland to not have a guy that they know, to not have those pieces set, like, you had an entire fall ball, you had preseason. So it was curious to me, and more so than Penn State and Hopkins, we can draw exactly the distinction that you made, where this is a Richmond team that came out firing. Maryland might have been unprepared, still trying to figure out a little bit more personnel. We can chalk more of this up to, hey, it's the first game of the season. There's still some teams figuring out. But that, I thought, was one of the more interesting comments of the entire weekend, because if you're not seeing a lot of difference between your midfielders, like, how are you going to develop and change? Like, how are you going to implement new strategies? How are you going to, and I'm reading too much into kind of a one-off sentence, but that one struck me by surprise as this Maryland team, if Tillman said, yeah, you know, we just have two guys who are crushing their dodges and we just need to figure out how to distribute the ball better. Like the lack of here's the problem and here's what we can do moving forward, even in just one potentially out of context sentence, makes me think that Maryland's close game, I don't even want to call them woes because wins are hard no matter what, but maybe keep an eye out for Maryland to have more close games and, you know, interesting matchups moving forward.
No doubt. I think that's exactly right. And I think it kind of underscores the point that I was making, which is just that it's going to require time. And the time is not just about the continuity and chemistry between the guys on the field and the coaching staff's ability to identify who's going to do best in what role, which could include end of game initiation, but it's also going to be time for these guys to develop confidence in and of themselves. And so, you know, the point that you made, and you know, there's something Belichickian about this, which is you can take a weakness and turn it into a strength, right? And if the lack of a alpha is Maryland's weakness, then I wouldn't be surprised if John Tillman and Mike Phipps figured out a way to turn that into a strength.
I would be. That's a tough strength. So moving on, another upset. The Loyola Greyhounds take it to Georgetown at home. And this was 18-10. The final score 18-10. This was a bit of an ass kicking. And I would say it flew under the radar because of some other, you know, more close, exciting, and otherwise bigger upsets. But this was another one that stood out to me where I'm like, huh, we might have to shift some of the over-under picks that we made last week, and some of the listeners might be losing some money, you know, figuring out what to do with Georgetown.
Yeah, so it's interesting because not only was it 18-10, but also Georgetown faced off really, really well. And that was a question mark for Loyola coming into this season. It has been for the last couple of seasons, basically since Bailey Savio graduated. But at the same time, you know, they battled James Ball, a Yale transfer, was Georgetown's primary faceoff guy who got hurt, didn't take every draw. And so when he was out of the game, they only went 2-for-8. So that obviously narrowed things up a little bit. But what an efficient performance from Loyola offensively. And I think that there were a lot of factors that led to it. But talking to some folks that were either at or watched the game, the comment was Georgetown was just really sloppy defensively. And post game, Kevin Warren acknowledged that and said, for a team that likes to slide a lot, we didn't slide frequently enough. And, you know, starting a freshman in Ty Banks, playing without two really experienced defenders in Will Bowen and James Donaldson, who graduated after last season, starting a freshman goalie in Anderson Moore, certainly some of that is to be expected. But what was interesting, again, you know, we have to contrast these things relative to expectations. And a lot of those expectations are formed by what we either heard or saw from these preseason scrimmages. And I didn't hear that those were issues for the Hoyas against Maryland. I did hear that Maryland hit a lot of pipes. So maybe the quote unquote result was a little bit misrepresentative from what you would have otherwise expected. But at the same time, I didn't hear that Georgetown was sloppy defensively. And so, it, you know, how quickly does it get cleaned up? How sustainable or repeatable is what Loyola did offensively? Evan James, 4 goals, 5 assists, just an absolutely lights out day. But it was for me, and especially early when the game wasn't not even like in doubt, but more so just we don't know what this game's going to look like. We know we're off to a hot start. Are we going to be able to, you know, keep this going? Because, you know, keep in mind, this is a Loyola team that lost to Georgetown last year by 16 goals. And there's not a ton of new personnel on this team. And so even when they were up, say, 8-5 or whatever, they couldn't have felt confident that Georgetown didn't have a comeback in them. And so guys like Matt Houston and Seth Higgins, when those midfielders were scoring in the first half, that made me think that Loyola showed up and had one of those all-around offensive days where it's going to be difficult for Georgetown to react because they can't decide who they want to try to take out of the game. And that was a luxury that Loyola had. And Charlie Toomey talked about it post-game, how they weren't going to let Graham Bundy and Alexander Verdaro, the Princeton grad transfer, beat them. And so as a result, Jordan Ray, the junior from Calvert Hall, shot, I believe, 5 of 10. And Toomey was like, that was the type of player that we were going to let beat us, for lack of a better way of doing it. And he did, to the tune of 5 goals. He scored half of his team's goals. But ultimately, Georgetown's offense wasn't nearly as efficient as Loyola's was. And, you know, their three top guys, so to speak, in Bundy, Verdaro, and I believe, I can't recall whether it was Patrick Kogan or James Carroll, but three of those guys combined to shoot, I believe it was 2 for 26 or 3 for 26. And so that's just not going to get it done. And, you know, I'm not jumping off of the Georgetown bandwagon. I also wasn't nearly as high on them as the consensus media was. I am a little, I'm ready to jump on the Loyola bandwagon. I'm not really sure. I actually came into this year with a similar expectation or point of view on Loyola as I did Georgetown. Or I'm sorry, as I did Denver, which is very pertinent to the way in which this conversation and podcast has gone, which is that they brought back a lot from last year. And that's good because it allows to build continuity and experience and everything that goes along with it. But at the end of last season, for both those teams, there was just something about them that left me feeling cold, especially at the offensive end of the field. And so I was just like, yeah, they return a lot, but is what they are returning good enough to, you know, in Loyola's case, be ranked 15th instead of 21st or 22nd, wherever I would have had them in my poll. And in Denver's case, be ranked 12th instead of 17th or 18th, which is where I had them. And not wanting to overreact to one result, but at the same time, you know, for Loyola to beat a quarterfinalist by 8 goals and for Denver to go on the road and beat a quarterfinalist in one of, in a miraculous comeback, like, we also shouldn't just ignore or disregard those results either. Now, in Loyola's case, we get an opportunity to evaluate them against another really, really high quality opponent, forthright, as they, like I said, head to College Park this weekend.
And for all you stats nerds out there, I'm wondering if there's a bigger difference year over year than 24 goals. You lose by 16, you win by 8. That has to be, if not the record, close to it. And it, I remember we always broke down the importance. I think it was like the most important 8 minutes of the game. The first two, the 2 minutes heading into half, the first 2 minutes of the first half, and the last 2 minutes of the game, if you know, if it was a close game. And to me, that, like, the first 2 minutes of the opening game of the season, it has the series the potential to set the tone for Loyola's offense of, we start out hot, we have hot hands, we can score on good defenses. Even though Georgetown's defense played sloppy, you know, I don't think Loyola is going to say, oh, well, we just got lucky. I think they have some great weapons to distribute to, and now the confidence going into Maryland, where a team that knows that they can pounce and go on a big run early is far and away the most dangerous team, even if they're, you know, mismatched off personnel-wise. Regardless, we hated playing against the teams that knew that they could score punches and bunches, and I think that Loyola is going to carry that confidence, whether they find themselves down to Maryland the first 2 minutes. Like, you, the importance of gaslighting yourself and gaslighting your own team into always believing that you can go score 3 or 4 or go. What did James score? Is like first 4 shots of the game or something like that. I don't care how sloppy the defense is. That's damn impressive. And so in the same way that we can now assume that Denver's going to be a dangerous team, regardless of the score, I think that Loyola just kind of crept up a little bit more on the, we'll call it the diaper meter of like, oh shit, you know, what could have potentially been a 12-8 victory is now going to be, you know, 12-11, and it's going to be a lot closer. So I love these psychology of the first games. What are teams taking and what are teams kind of going to be worried about? And I think that Loyola had the biggest jump of confidence, even more so than Denver. So that's my player psychoanalyst takeaway. And speaking of carrying momentum, Syracuse, Vermont. I'm saying it, I'm scared of Syracuse this year. I am going to continue to discredit them on Twitter to get people mad about it. But this was exactly how we kind of talked about the entirety of Syracuse last season on this podcast. We said they're young, they're going to figure it out. They have a disgusting amount of talent. And when this clicks, this team is going to be potentially in the top of the ACC. Obviously, it's Notre Dame, Duke, Virginia, but Syracuse, after this first matchup, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a now four-horse race, because, boy, they were humming. They looked good. They didn't have a lot of spots where I was, like, trying to nitpick. And Syracuse is a dangerous team, and I'd watch out for them. I would watch out for the Orange, which is nice because they haven't had that same lethality in the last couple of years. So it's almost nice to see Syracuse back in the mix again, overreacting to the first game where they blew out Vermont.
Yeah, so to the point about overreaction, I mean, you know, I want to see them. This is a rebuilding Vermont team, and there's a lot of talent, but there's also a long way to go. And I would just put them into the category of, you know, a team that is going to get better over the course of the season. I want to see Syracuse react to and respond to a team that can go punch for punch with them offensively, and then just see what they look like at the end of a close game. And, you know, it's not that I picked Syracuse to make it to the Final Four. So I am as high on them as you can almost possibly be. But at the same time, I also think that their questions are very small margins, right? And so, you know, they host Maryland on the 17th. I've already said I'm going to be there. It's going to be incredible. And part of the reason is because we know that they're really talented. And so what they showed on film on against Vermont, like there was nothing really that should have been surprising. I mean, you know, it was encouraging to see the face-off situation improve. And it was unsurprising to see the variety of dangerous weapons they had. I mean, honestly, like if there was a surprise, it was Jake Stevens' contributions offensively, because, you know, that was kind of always a luxury good when he was at Princeton. It felt a little bit more like the catalyst that kind of got Syracuse going in the second quarter after they, you know, were a little slow to get things going in the first quarter. So, you know, it kind of, for me, all swirls up into the what Joey Spolina offers is in contrast with what we talked about with Maryland. They know where the ball is going to start when it is a, you know, kind of nut crunch time moment. What Christian Mulé brings is a compliment, right? It gives them an option. It gives them something that is something other than Joey Spolina, even though you're probably not going to use it that often. And then now with English and Stevens and Roa and all the other guys who got into the score sheet, there's complimentary pieces. Owen Hiltz, the fact that, you know, we spent this much time talking about Syracuse and didn't, you know, mention his name yet. And the fact that Trey Deer, New Balance All-American, didn't even get on the field effectively, you know, in the kind of starters minutes against Vermont. It's all huge, hugely significant. But again, it all kind of swirls up into we expected this from Syracuse. Now we just need to see how it manifests in those smallest margins.
And we're running up on a bit of a time crunch, so kind of popping around and looking at the other games. Lehigh taking it to Rutgers. Ohio State having to claw back against Utah. Shout out Gannon Matthews, Idaho kid. Good grit on Ohio State's roster. Merrimack having a hot start. They're always really good in February. They're the anti-Duke. What are some of your other big takeaways from this weekend?
Well, apparently I am a cranberry farmer who doesn't know anything about the price of tuna. So thank you to the greasy Rutgers alum with a vulgar Twitter handle who wanted to make sure that I knew exactly how stupid I am.
Can I just read that tweet? Can I just read that tweet for context?
Absolutely.
So, oh my goodness, because this was the funniest thing. So this greasy Rutgers, you know, probably had a couple beers. Your top 20 was trash, you nerd. And I'm making this the PG version. The fact that you and the rest of the Inside Lacrosse Poindexter Nerd Collective have become the leaders in lacrosse media is a farce. It's like a cranberry farmer opining on the tuna fish market. Cranberry men don't know shit about fish. That's one of the greatest tweets I've ever seen in my life. Okay, continue. I just wanted that context.
The most disappointing thing about the tweet is that he's now gone back to the joke like three or four times 24 hours later. I'm like, come on, bro. Like, you got to diversify. Show me that you're not a one-trick pony with your cranberry to fish economy reference. So I think ultimately this guy's in commodities, and those are his two areas, and he just knows. He's like, you know what I don't ask people from Massachusetts that have worked for Ocean Spray about? Starkist. So anyhow. Yeah, Lehigh. I thought that, you know, for them to lose Christian Mulé, John Sidorsky, Justin Tiernan, Mike Sisselberger, and Kevin Cassis, and then come out and have that type of performance against a Rutgers squad that put it on their opponents in their preseason scrimmages, Villanova and BU. It was an impressive showing for Will Scudder and his group. So I think if you're a Mountain Hawk fan, you should be excited by what that result indicates. On top of that, disappointing kind of last 40 minutes for Utah to come out of the gate so hot and then not be able, I think they had two goals in their last 40 minutes, you know, to not be able to sustain it, especially because they were in a situation that was pretty equivalent to what we talked about with Denver in terms of West team traveling east, playing in early start time. So, you know, an opportunity for the Utes that was missed, but also, you know, encouraging one for Ohio State coming off of a disappointing campaign last year. So, you know, I know you want to finish by talking briefly about what today means for Selection Sunday. And, you know, if you're Penn State, a loss to Colgate, it's likely to be outside of the top 30. So it's going to be a quote unquote bad loss when it comes to Selection Sunday. I don't think a bad loss is going to be disqualifying for a team that has four or five top 20 wins. You know, you're going to have probably at least one, if not two, top five wins, an additional top 10 win, and then, you know, round that out with one or two top 20 wins. My expectation is that, you know, based on what we're going to see with these results going forward, I think that there is going to be two or three, maybe four bubble teams that have a non-top 20 or top 30 loss. And so as a result, you know, I don't think it's going to disqualify you. I think a second one would. So if you've got one on your, if you've got one on your list, if you're Penn State, you know, you can't drop another game to a team outside of the top 20 or top 30 and then, you know, expect to be a serious at-large contender. So, huge outcome. And then obviously, you know, for some of these other teams that are rebounding like Georgetown and Hopkins, I don't know, full steam ahead, figure it out. Your future's in front of you. Nobody loses a national championship game in February.
Figure it out. And if you need a morale booster, your party theme for the bye weekend should be dog wedding. And then who could be mad at a dog wedding themed party?
Correct.
Well, I hope there are many dog weddings in your future, Terry, and I hope I get all the content from it. Thank you. I am going to go get ready to ESPNU. So if you're listening to this, the game's already going to happen, but you'll be able to go watch it on the ESPN app. So how about it?
Enjoy, Nick. Love you.
Love you too.